Hey, everybody, just a quick note about this episode and the show before we actually get to it. One, you'll hear some audio jumps. They shouldn't be a big deal, but I just want to explain what those are. When we recorded this at Convergence with Anne and some other people, we were trying to find quiet spaces. There weren't very many. We found a nice spot, and it turned out that somebody decided from the hotel or somewhere decided they would drag chairs across the ground. This is a sort of rock, stone, pebbly kind of pavement. And so it made this horrendous screech noise, and I had to do my best to cut it out at the time of recording, which was difficult, and then in post. So you'll hear those jumps. It's mostly funny because, duh, I mean, like, it's just hilarious. Other thing, there are lots of episodes that are coming up. There are a few more Convergence episodes left. There are a couple ICFA episodes we need to drop, and there are lots of Worldcon episodes. We're also working on interviews with Anne Leckie, Celine Kiernan, Emmy Itaranta, who wrote Memory of Water, and we're also hopefully getting an Iranian author on, which is going to be really cool. So I'm going to shut up now. I'm going to let you guys get to this episode, but I really hope you enjoy it, and thanks for listening. I really appreciate it.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But to Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fandy Show.
Interview with Anne Lyle, swordsman, theater cross-dressers, and magic. Oh my.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guest is Anne Lyle. Hello.
Hi.
So, really quick, folks are probably not familiar with your books, or maybe some of them must be. We've got at least 9 listeners.
Ten. So,
10 sounds about good. So at least one of them, for sure, as familiar with your books, because we're like an angry robot ninjas now because Mike Underwood's on the show. So quickly tell us a little bit about your series, and, you know, just kind of tell us the impetus behind them and where they came from, that kind of thing.
Sure. Okay, so the books are set in 16th century Europe. They're a kind of alternate history fantasy in which non-humans were discovered in the New World living alongside the Native Americans, and the central premise of the book is that some of these creatures called Skraelings come over to England as a sort of ambassadorial party, and the hero is asked to be the bodyguard of the ambassador for reasons that he has no idea why they've asked him, but this eventually is revealed in the first book, and then he goes on to have other adventures involving the Skraelings in the subsequent volumes.
Excellent. You want to start?
Yeah. So where did you... The books feature a lot of swordplay, and I find those are a great feature of the book, the way you describe sword fighting, and especially in the second book where the main character, Mal, is teaching sword fighting. It was almost like a clinic in how to learn how to fight with a sword. Not Flynn with a sword, but fight with a sword. So where's your interest in swords and sword fighting come from?
Well, funny you mention Errol Flynn. I actually grew up with all those swashbuckling Hollywood movies, Burt Lancaster and Stuart Granger. Oh, Scaramouche is one of my favorite uh-huh. movies. So I love all that Hollywood swashbuckling, but at the same time I'm aware that that's not a very realistic style of sword fighting. I'm also a big fan of medieval and Renaissance history, so I've also read up a lot on the actual techniques of the times. I had a go at fencing, but I'm not really fit enough. My reaction times aren't fast enough. But I love the whole topic, so I just researched it, and yeah, my sword fights tend to be very short, because in real life they would have been very short. It was mostly it's a bit like it's more like a Wild West gunfight in that it's all about waiting for the right moment to get in there and kill your opponent before he kills you.
Yeah. I think there was rendition of one of Shakespeare's plays. I want to say it was Macbeth. Macbeth has a sword fight in the end, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's the whole point of it.
I can't remember which movie it was, but they're in full armor in the film, mm-hmm. and they had this just glorious battle. But it's fairly realistic because they're wearing armor. So like, you know, one little...
Yeah, and obviously in the Middle Ages they were fighting with broadswords.
Right, yeah.
Which is a completely different technique. From rapier fighting, which is what I've been writing about.
Right, and in fact, I think, if I recall correctly, and you may know this since you've done a little bit more research, the quicker the weapon, the less armor people would wear, because they wouldn't need it, because obviously you can't run around, like, in full night gear, and like...
Yes, exactly. Plus, rapiers and small swords are more of a civilian weapon anyway. They would be worn for self-defense in the street. Ostensibly. And you wouldn't walk around the streets of London dressed in full armor.
The first open carry was the sword.
Yes.
Oh yeah. They're very much a fashion item in 16th century London. Although some cities banned them, like Venice, you weren't allowed to wear weapons openly.
The open carry movement does not like Venice.
Apparently not. Well, it's really interesting that the evolution of sword play. I mean, I obviously don't know terribly much about it, but just learning about the changes in style and how even when weapons change, the styles of fight have to change, and the way battles have to be played obviously change. I mean, when the invention of the crossbow changes how all engagements take place.
Sure.
And later on you get cannons and mm-hmm. muskets and things like that.
Pikemen making cavalry obsolete and so forth.
Right, pikemen. Or even, you know, formations. You go back to, like, the phalanx, as a formation, mm-hmm. Which was very difficult to combat. You had to find new methods. So in your research, did you find any particular interesting things about how the change in weaponry has resulted in changes in perhaps fighting style or that kind of thing?
I've only studied quite a small period, so it wasn't so much the change as the fact that there were different and competing approaches to fighting styles in that period. I mean, you're talking about wearing armor. Obviously, there were different kinds of swords. The type of sword you took into battle wasn't the kind of sword you wore on the street any more than, you know, people would carry hopefully not carry a submachine gun around. And at the same time, yeah, for example, Italian styles of fencing were very fashionable in London, everything Italian. So you had Italian swordsmasters giving lessons to young gentlemen. In fact, my hero Mal has mentions that he's had lessons from Saviolo, who was one of the famous tutors at the time. But you also got English swordsmasters like George Silver, who would write saying, "Oh, these poncy Italian styles, you know, they're not manly," and so on. So they're, but the same. We've subsequently discovered that even the Italians weren't as poncy as Silver made out. There are manuals that have been discovered very recently that show some pretty dirty tactics being taught, certainly to advanced students. Maybe in the early lessons it was all about the basic, simple techniques, but then it was they'd go on to all kinds of wrestling and grabbing your partner and so on.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm just totally wrong, but I imagine at some point when you realize you're killing people, it kind of doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter, because you don't want to die either.
No, exactly. So if you were just like a gentleman dilettante, you maybe learn the stylish stuff just because it's fashionable. But yeah, if you go on to become an advanced student, you want to learn how to keep yourself alive,
right,
by any means necessary.
Even a minor injury can be
fatal. Totally, yeah. Particularly with rapiers, which are piercing weapons, so they would produce quite deep wounds that couldn't be dressed. You know, there's no antibiotics.
Right.
So any kind of deep penetrating wound was you're probably going to be fatal. I mean, a little cut, they could stitch up and, you know, wash out with wine, and you had a reasonable chance of getting over it. But deep piercing wounds.
Right, yeah, one really good shot in your stomach, you could rupture an organ, and that's it.
Well, if we're talking about guns, then one really good shot in the stomach, and you'd be dead instantly because of the black powder weapons being so brutal. But even a stab from a tiny rapier point, if it goes more than an inch deep, then you're looking at some
very likely death. Yeah,
a long lingering death.
Oh, that's not fun.
No,
I don't want to go that way.
I don't want to go that way either.
Yeah.
Another major theme in your novel is the whole idea of theater and theater folk in the personage of Kobe, the other main character of the series. Well, where's your interest in theater and theater folk come from?
Well, my parents met through amateur dramatics, so I hung out in theaters from, you know, when I was old enough to walk, basically. So it's always interested me. I directed the. We had a house play competition when I was in the sixth form. I directed our house play, which won.
Yes.
And then a few years ago, I was in a bookshop in Ely, which is in East Anglia, just north of Cambridge, and I came across a book about Christopher Marlowe, who is a contemporary of Shakespeare, a famous poet and playwright. But is also famously murdered in an argument over the bill in a restaurant.
Supposedly.
Well, the book was all about actually his murder. It wasn't just a biography of him, and it looked at all the evidence that he was in fact a spy.
Yes.
For Walsingham, and the evidence is extremely convincing that he was. I mean, he was allowed to take time out from university on Her Majesty's service. And exempted from the fines he would have had to pay for bunking off uni. And he was involved in counterfeiting money in the Low Countries and stuff. So whether or not he was disappeared or the various, you know, conspiracy theories at the Marlowe Society go on about, he was definitely not just a playwright. Mm. And I was fascinated by the... by the mingling of the court and the theatre and the politics and the spying. It was just a wonderful mixture of plot possibilities.
Yeah, and Marlowe's a very interesting figure also because it's something that I think we had talked about before your Shakespeare panel, Paul, was he's sometimes thought to have been the original writer of the Shakespeare plays by certain people.
I don't think he was. I mean, the people who think that his death was a cover story to get rid of him because he knew too much and he was a bit of a loose cannon. And there is some circumstantial evidence that he might be identified with a British agent who was in France after the period of his death.
Oh, interesting.
And that I can imagine that, you know, he might have provided some inspiration to Shakespeare by, you know, if they exchanged letters in secret or something like that. But I don't think he wrote Shakespeare's plays.
I don't think so either. No. Out of curiosity, because you've kind of brought up this theater thing, and obviously you had your role in theater, as you've already just mentioned. In what ways has working with theater or in theater or around theater, or even just reading it as an interested party, has that influenced your own work, either as a sort of in a writing of style or just in terms of the interest you present? That's a big question.
It is a big question. I haven't really thought about it. I suppose that I did like Shakespeare in school. I didn't really like English lessons all that much. I found that having to read particular books and critique them, I didn't enjoy. But I loved the Shakespeare lessons and reading out the plays and acting them out and stuff like that. I suppose on a personal level, just being involved with stage stuff is good for self-confidence.
Okay.
Even if you're quite shy and introverted.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, so well, you were talking about theater and self-conscious. I'm gonna swing over to the third.
Oh, I love the smell of the grill. Hi, love it.
I'm gonna swing over to the third aspect of what we talked about, a little about the story, but I talked about the theater. The third part is the fantastic element, i.e. having, I kept thinking them as aliens rather than indigenous, natives that were just non-human. So what was your inspiration for, you have these elements of 16th century England and an altered history. Why bring in the Skraelings? What was your inspiration for bringing them in?
I just like playing around with, biology in my writing. I came up with this idea of having some kind of, non-humans that weren't based on the traditional elves, dwarves, folklore kind of thing. So I'm a biologist by my background. I have a degree in zoology. So I pulled in some bits of animal behaviour and used those as the basis of the culture. And I just kind of created this in a vacuum originally, just as a thought experiment. And then I thought, also my interest in 16th century history and how that's very much about the discovery and exploitation of the Americas. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool if I could come up with a way of keeping the conquistadors and people out of the Americas, just to change history. And so I thought, well, what if there were people living there who weren't vulnerable to smallpox, and maybe had more technology, so that they were better at resisting the Europeans. But at the same time, I didn't want to take away the Native Americans, because that would kind of get rid of the whole point of it. So I had the Skraelings evolve in the Americas, and then almost die off when the megafauna died off in the Americas, so that when the humans came, there were maybe not as many Skraelings, and so they were kind of a minority that had been pushed back to the East Coast. But in doing so, that they formed a kind of buffer between the incoming Native American humans and the Europeans who later tried to come from the other direction. And kind of decided that, yeah, they'd had enough of being squeezed, and they were kind of happy with their sort of symbiotic, friendly relationship with the Native Americans, and they weren't going to let yet another group of humans come in and kick them around.
That's really fascinating, because you never say in the book, we don't actually get to the American book, spoiler. I mean, they threaten at one point to sail west, but they never actually get there. But I kept thinking, okay, are they native to Earth? I kept thinking, are they landed aliens? I didn't know you'd ask me these questions. You've answered my question. Okay, so they evolved on Earth and basically nearly went with the rest of the megafauna at the end of the Pleistocene.
Yes.
That's brilliant. I didn't know at the time that you were so
interested in biology. Okay, it's okay.
It's difficult because I didn't want to info dump. So, it's hard to get across that kind of complex thing, especially when the humans and to a lesser extent the Skraelings don't know the full picture anyway.
Yeah, it's also, yeah, I mean, the idea of info dumping it, in a way it's kind of enticed you, the mystery of not knowing, in fact, which you totally ruined. No, I'm just kidding. No, but at the same time, it's sort of this interesting reveal, because now you can, if you go back to read the book, which I'm sure you will, Paul, because you read all the time, you might actually start picking up clues that you may have unintentionally or intentionally left. Little things, or it could be really an interesting sort of rereading process.
Especially any part involving the Skraelings. I have to read that a lot more carefully now. Yeah. Pick up the hints I didn't quite get the first time.
Yeah, there are hints that people said, no, there's no humans mentioned from the Americas. Well, actually there is. There's the, like, stallholder Native American stallholder in book one.
I caught that, yeah. So I was trying to figure out where the Skraelings fit in with that, and not quite gelling it. And I don't, we shouldn't go too spoilery about what they are and what they can do. So I'll switch topics. Book one is very much a London book. It's like most of the action revolves in and around London. London is a character. But in book two, you go to Venice. Why Venice?
Just because I love Venice. I went there in 2003 for the first time and absolutely adored it. It's a very good place to go for your into history or historical fiction, because it really hasn't changed a great deal in the last 400 years. It's a bit more built up now, there are fewer gardens and more houses, but it's still, because there are no streets big enough for motor vehicles, except right towards the mainland. So it's all pedestrianized apart from the canals. So it's incredibly quiet. Even in the 16th century, there were hardly any horses in the city, because again, the streets are like corridors, a lot of them. Tiny, tiny streets. So it's like stepping back 400 years. It's very easy to get yourself into the atmosphere, and it's a beautiful place. So I just couldn't resist setting a book there. Plus, they were politically quite sympathetic to the English, because the Venetians, although they were a Catholic nation, they really hated the Pope sticking his nose in their business. So they were kind of enemies of the Papal States, which kind of, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. So it felt like a good place to visit.
So, just out of curiosity, what about London? What made you decide to set a book specifically in London? I mean, maybe you're from there, so.
No, I'm not from there. I lived there for about 15 years. I don't really like modern day London all that much. But back in the 16th century, there weren't many cities. Cities are just, I find, much more interesting places to write about. London was where everything happened. It's where the court was. It was where all the theatres were. I mean, theatre companies went on tour around the country to different noblemen's houses and so on, but all the professional theatres were in London. So it was the logical place to set anything political or theatrical set in that era.
Do you think that has a lot? Because I mean, Paul and I have certainly talked to a number of authors who've used London very explicitly. Like, this is a London book. Do you get the sense that because of London's sort of central placement, as you're talking about an older period in time, it is like the center of everything in a way. That even though it may not necessarily be the true center anymore, that's still, because of that history, it remains such a fascinating space?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, Londoners still think that, you know, London is the country. The rest of the country is like somewhere else and a bit weird as far as Londoners are concerned. It does have a huge percentage of the UK population. So, yeah, it does loom large in all our consciousness wherever we live.
I mean, it's certainly the place that gets the huge tourist spot.
Although I do live in another huge tourist spot, Cambridge, which is not far away. And it has the advantage that it's about the same size as Elizabethan London, the city centre.
Okay.
It has lots of late medieval and Tudor buildings, secular buildings, which is unusual. We obviously have lots of churches, but most other things, the old Elizabethan palaces, apart from Hampton Court, most of those have been torn down. So it's a good place to live, to get the feel of Elizabethan London, really. This is very cosmopolitan because we get visitors from all over the world.
Oh, excellent. Which of course, London would have, even in an earlier time, because of its centrality. Yeah. It's very interesting.
It is very interesting. I appreciated a lot in the book that you have the Skraelings and that they affect English history. I appreciated that you had the wherewithal to actually change how global events would affect in England. We don't get to see that so much in the rest of the world. Can you give us any hints about where else the history has gone left off of the main, off the track that we know because of the presence of the Skraelings?
I didn't make many changes to the rest of history, mostly because it's a fairly recent thing of the Skraelings coming over. I mean, one thing that's much more of a long-term effect will be that the Spanish economy is going to go down the toilet because there is no influx of gold and silver from the New World.
Ah, okay.
In the future of my stories, the history is probably going to change a lot more than it has done by the time of the period that I'm writing about.
And obviously the huge change we've ever talked about is that the invasion from the Europeans is basically put on like hold because of this position, this change in the fabric of North America.
Yes, that's right.
And I'm guessing also the Spanish are going to have so many of their own issues. As you said, they're going to go and you're going to have a Great Depression of sorts. But I do find this really interesting because, there have been alternate histories in which people have imagined, you know, that the Native Americans somehow survived and, like, maybe the Europeans didn't settle there or what have you. But you've taken this very interesting path where you've actually injected not only that, a little bit of that kind of alternate history where the Europeans, their influence is obviously, like, kind of shut down a bit. They're not invading in the same sense. But additionally, you have this new people that have come in, this different race,
species,
as it were. And I do find that really interesting. How has the reaction been so far to that really dramatic shift?
Mostly it's been positive. I think people just like the idea. You get a few people who got the kind of wrong end of the stick and thought that, you know, I was... Because the word Skraeling was applied to the Native Americans by the Vikings. It's a Viking term.
Interesting. Okay.
Which was used to describe the possibly the Inuit that they met in the far north of America, and there are various interpretations of what it means, and some people think it means, you know, scrawny folk because the Vikings were big 6-foot guys, but I took an alternative interpretation of it, which it could be related to the word for writing, you know, our word scrawl. That's why I imagine they have tattoos. So I imagine them as being like the Picts. The name Picts means painted people. So I imagine the Skraelings as being the tattooed guys, and the Vikings probably couldn't tell them from Native Americans anyway because they all looked strange to them. And it's just that, you know, some of them have these tattooed faces.
That's fascinating. Okay,
that is fascinating. So I did, without trying to get into spoiler action, the full amount of badass. So you do have these Skraelings, but you also introduce what slowly becomes clear is a fantasy element. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a while I was trying to read it as technology, but as the novels go on, kind of spoilers. It's clearly magic. So,
well, there's some of each. They definitely have some technology that the Europeans don't have. They're very good at chemistry, I decided. So they have chemoluminescence. So they have lamps that use chemoluminescence rather than fire.
I love lamps, yeah.
There are also some definite fantasy.
So why add fantasy to all this?
You can blame our publisher for that.
it did
have a little bit of fantasy in it, but they basically said, you know, we want more fantasy if we're going to buy these books. So I went through notes of previous projects and I found another fantasy element that I could add to the existing one that meshed with it quite nicely and that gave it a bit more oomph.
That's interesting. Because it seems like a strange request considering it's basically alternate history, but I guess they really wanted to play up that fantastic element.
Well, it did have one element that was... some people would say is more fantasy than science fiction, which, for spoiler reasons, I won't go into. But I've read another science fiction alternate history novel that includes this element, and nobody's gone, oh my god, it's fantasy. So
interesting.
Oh god.
Okay. Which I should probably not tell you, because then you guess what it is.
Shh. Paul's whispering the answer.
No, I'm not. No.
He's mouthing the answer like a mime.
No, I am not mouthing the answer like a mime.
You lie. anyway, well, actually, it's a good question since we brought up the publisher. I've probably said this a million times. Edgar Robot is basically my favorite publisher. Sorry, Tor, but they're just nicer to me. But if you guys want to send me a basket of fruit, that would be, you know, that'd be good in the war. But anyway, your relationship, you published, you have book four or book three?
Three books.
Okay. So you published three books with them. How's your relationship been with them? I mean, I know the obvious answer is it's lovely. But I mean, you know, it is, there are your publisher, they published three books. So I mean, it's been, I'm sure, a very interesting experience being published with them.
I mean, it started when I met, Mark and Lee in the bar at Fantasy Con 4 years ago, late night in the bar. I actually stopped to talk to a writer friend, and he said, oh, you must come and meet the guys from Angry Robot. They're looking for new writers. And so I ended up pitching my book at like 2 a.m. over a glass of whiskey, and Mark saying, oh yeah, send me some chapters. So that's the kind of set the tone for our relationship. But yeah, it's not like, for me at least, it hasn't been quite like working with a big publisher. I used to work in non-fiction publishing. So I kind of know the sort of behind the scenes process. I don't know if that's changed how I work with them at all, but I've certainly been a lot more involved in the cover art process than writers typically are. The first one, Mark and I bounced ideas back and forth, but it was mostly him doing the brief with some supporting materials from me, and then the second was basically my brief, which Marco just, you know, sent to my artist with a few extra notes.
I love that second cover with Kobe and the God. That's my favorite of the three covers by far.
Yeah, I'm getting Larry to sign a copy of the artwork. I will.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've heard this a number of times about Angry Robot, that they do incorporate the author into the production process more than most publishers do.
Yes.
You know, asking for their input.
I think most publishers at least ask for ideas, but then if they don't like your ideas, they'll totally ignore them.
Yeah, I mean, they'll sell you, we can't do that because we can't sell your book.
They'll maybe ask for a character description and stuff, because obviously the artist doesn't have time to read your book.
Right.
But it's certainly unusual for to go to a publisher and say, this is what I want on the cover of my book, and say, awesome, we like that.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's one of the things that I love about Angry Robot is their relationship with authors, and on top of that, obviously, relationship with readers and reviewers, etc. That model for me is just really great. I feel
I like the fact that they're clearly in touch with 21st century publishing. You know, they publish in the UK and worldwide simultaneously. It's so frustrating as a reader to find a book that you like and then discover you cannot buy the ebook because it's only been released in North America.
Yeah.
Or sometimes the other way around. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can order a paperback from Amazon.com and get it shipped across the Atlantic, but I can't buy an ebook.
Yeah.
And get those electrons downloaded to my
I agree. I think as a reader, primarily as a reader, that's super frustrating. Like you, especially when you're a fan of an author and you're like, they have a new book out, but I have to wait 2 months in the US before I can get the paperback because it's only available in the UK or the only available wherever. Or sometimes the other way around, obviously. I mean, I don't live in England, so it's not
And they're also anti-DRM, which I totally approve of.
Yes.
So I've changed e-reader several times over the last few years, so having books that I can move from one device to the next and not be breaking the laws.
And it's obviously been generally speaking, fairly successful for them. They've been doing very well.
Yeah, I mean, other publishers have followed suit because they've seen how, you know, people are doing it and not going bust.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the old school publishers can definitely learn a lot from Angry Robot.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not to say that those publishers suck. I'm just saying there's things that you should learn, you know, from other people.
But also they don't have a mega corporation breathing down their necks and saying, you know, this is the way we've always done it, so that's the way you do it. They've been able to innovate maybe in the way that bigger publishers can't, because they have that inertia of an established system.
Yeah, it can be more difficult to change when you have a rigid system in place. Whereas if you start by saying we're going to do stuff a little differently, you have a little bit more freedom. Yeah, I can agree with that. Yeah, but you know, it's changing though. Publishing is definitely changing.
Yeah, well, it has to, because you know, you can't hold back the tide of technology.
Yeah,
and it's no good saying, oh, we have to have DRM because otherwise we'll get pirated. Because you'll get pirated anyway, whether you've got DRM or not.
I'll just say it is really easy to crack DRM.
Oh, yeah, you just...
Really, really easy. So it's really pointless. If somebody wants to take the book and crack the DRM and then put it on the internet for free, they can do it in 2 minutes. I'm not kidding. I've done it because I've had so many trouble with DRM books on my Nook.
Yeah.
That I just crack it so I can read it. And I hate to have to do that because I know I'm breaking the law. Sorry, I'm going to prison now. but it is. I mean, I would never release a book. I think that's wrong. But if I want to read it, I'm going to find a way to read it. Dang it. I bought it. But yeah, and DRM is a really silly, silly system.
Yeah, it doesn't help other readers, and it doesn't help the writers either, because it only lends fuel to the pirates.
Yeah, and I imagine it turns people off when they buy a book from a publisher, because like, the real honest truth is, I imagine most readers probably don't sit around and think like, you know, oh, I like this publisher, maybe it was a mistake, or like they just see one book by an author and they just go, that book, the DRM didn't work, I'm never buying anything from that author again, because they're afraid it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
And that's not fair to the author. It's also not good for the publisher.
No.
You know, and oftentimes that person's not going to write a review saying that. They're just not going to buy it again. And I feel like you'd lose potential people. So it's good. Angry Robot doesn't do that. Yay for them.
Yay for them. Yeah. So you finished the trilogy. Before we launch into asking what are you doing now, what was the experience like of actually finishing a trilogy seemingly on time? I don't know behind you, but it came out in good order.
It's almost accusatory.
No! Okay, that was awkward. My apologies.
It's okay. That was adorable.
No, you're right. I did hand it in later than originally agreed, but because they were putting them out so quickly, they were like, yeah, okay, it's fine.
So did the end of Prince of Lies, did you see that ending when you started writing Alchemist?
Not when I started writing it. I think by the end of the first finished draft, I kind of saw where, I mean, the arc of the series is Mal's sort of character arc, and I knew roughly where I wanted to take him, because I'd already rough drafted the second book by that point, and so I had an idea of how it was all going to pan out. I just wasn't exactly sure what the events of the final book would be that would get them to that point.
So what are you working on now?
I am working on a secondary world fantasy. I decided I wanted a break from historical. I love writing about historical people. For one thing, you don't have to make stuff up. It's all there on Wikipedia and the internet. You can say, I need a nobleman for this particular position. You type in, do a few clicks around, find out who's born around the right period, and just pick somebody. So it's so easy these days to write in a well-documented setting and period like Elizabethan London. But at the same time, it's quite restrictive. You know, you can do a lot with the political history, you know, the alternate history, and you bring in aliens and stuff, but you can't really change the culture. Otherwise, it stops being that period. So you're kind of stuck with this sexist, xenophobic, homophobic culture right across Europe. And there's not really anything you can do about that. If you want to play with any of those kind of concepts, you've got to go somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
So I decided I was going to do something secondary world. So I'm just kind of working on that. I'm kind of pottering around, but I've been a bit busy with my day job, so I don't have anything ready to send out to my agent yet.
Fair enough. So just a quick question, actually, since we're talking about your work here. Who would you say are some of your influences, either directly, like, on your actual writing, or just people that you just love to read?
Well, I've read so many books over the years. I don't think I could single anybody out as, oh, yeah, that so-and-so inspired me. It's a big mishmash of Ursula Le Guin and Tolkien and Terry Pratchett and Shakespeare and all kinds of things. I mean, I've been reading Terry Pratchett since his first book came out in paperback in the UK in the mid 80s. So I think just by osmosis, things like Ankh Morpork, I'm sure, although it was inspired by historical London, has then re-inspired me to write about historical London.
Oh, nice. Cool. That's an interesting way to do it. Well, excellent. So really quick, tell everybody where they can find you on the internet.
That's nice and easy. It's just annlyle.com.
Okay, and Lyle is L-Y-L-E.
L-Y-L-E, and that's Anne with an E.
Do you have a Twitter, any of those things?
I do, also, at Anne Lyle.
Excellent.
As mentioned, having a nice, short, but slightly unusual name is very easy to get your Twitter handle.
Awesome. And on that note, if you want to go check out her work...
And you should.
And you should. AngryRobot.com. AngryRobotBooks.com.
AngryRobotBooks.com. I have a link to all my titles.
Yep.
And a link through to their online ebook store where you can buy my titles DRM-free.
There you go. Yep. And you should, I would recommend buying straight from the publisher just because it's nice.
And it's available in EPUB and Mobi, so you can read it on your Kindle or your Nook or your Kobo or your iPad or whatever you like.
Excellent. So everybody should go check out the books right away. And on that note, so thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Yep. And thanks, Paul, for joining me.
Oh, this is a pleasure. She's one of my favorite authors of the last few years.
Awesome. And on that note, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.